supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Gottlieb, thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Civil rights is as much of an issue today as it was 50 years ago when it became the law of the land. So why are so few high schools teaching it? And what are our children learning about civil rights, women's rights, and all of the other human rights so pressing in today's world? On today's show, we'll learn about both the problems and some of the exciting things being done to repair them right here in Philadelphia. First, we'll hear from Maureen Costello, who leads the Southern Poverty Law Center's Teaching Tolerance Project, one of the nation's leading providers of anti-bias education resources. Later on, we'll hear from Reverend Stephen Lawrence from White Rock Baptist Church in West Philadelphia. He's the chair of NUCOR, which stands for New Conversation on Race and Ethnicity. And we'll hear from Divya Arya. She's a high school student at Lower Merion High School. She's president and founder of the Intercultural Youth Council, whose mission is to spread knowledge and awareness of different faith and global cultural traditions and to promote youth involvement in achieving peace and conflict resolution. But first, let's listen to a conversation I recently had with Maureen Costello at the Southern Poverty Law Center. So, Maureen, I'm aware that your recently released study, Teaching the Movement, 2014, the State of Civil Rights Education here in the United States. You took a look at all 50 states in the country, and you looked at how effectively they taught about the civil rights movement. New Jersey and Pennsylvania got a D.
Yes.
So what did you look at? How did you look at this and why?
Well, you know, let me go back a bit, because the first time we issued the report was in 2011. And what we had noticed was that the NAEP test results had come out. These are the national achievement tests that the federal government gives to 12th graders. And the social studies test showed that only 2% of students could correctly identify a quote, perhaps the most famous quote, from Brown versus the Board of Education. And all they had to do was say, this is about schools and segregation. And only 2% of graduating seniors could do so. So we said to ourselves, what is this about? What explains this? How are teachers actually teaching the movement? And it was too difficult in a way, or a massive kind of project, to find out how teachers are actually teaching it. So this was at the same time that many states adopted the Common Core standards, and lots of governors had just gone out publicly and said, standards are important. They measure what we expect from students. And we said, great, let's see what they expect from students and from teachers about civil rights education. So the first time we did the report in 2011, we literally looked at every state's standards. What did they require teachers to teach? And what we found was that, in general, not much. Some states stood out as having very thorough content standards, and those states tended to be in the South. Now, we did hear from a bunch of states.
Any explanation about
geography, first of all? Virtually every state has a year on local history. And so, naturally, if many of the events took place in the South, you're going to see lessons about it. I think it also had to do with where the African-American population was concentrated. What we found is that you had lessons about the civil rights movement in the South, and then you had them in states like New York and Illinois, where there are large concentrations of African-Americans. But basically, the further west you went, the less likely you were.
Maureen, you said these things happen in the South from civil rights. What things are you talking about?
Most of the events of the civil rights movement. So, for example, the Montgomery bus boycott, the march from Selma to Montgomery, the Birmingham Children's March, Mississippi Freedom Summer, the Freedom Rides, where interstate buses were brought through the South, or the lunch counter sit-ins.
When I first asked you about this, the second part of my question was, why? Why are we teaching this? And you could argue it's 50 years ago. And are these details important, especially that one detail about Brown versus Board of Ed? How does that help our children today?
Well, first of all, I would argue that Brown versus the Board of Ed is not a detail. Brown versus the Board of Education overturned Plessy versus Ferguson, which was the basis for Jim Crow laws. So what Brown versus the Board of Education said is separate is inherently unequal, and laid the basis for this country living up to its promise. Why do children need to know that? They need to know it for two reasons. First of all, it is an intrinsic part of our history. I'm a history teacher. I was a history teacher for 18 years. It is impossible to teach American history without looking at our history of slavery and also our history of oppression of a variety of groups and how those groups have in turn secured their own piece of the American promise. But the other reason for teaching it is not about history. Lots of people argue that it's not that important to know about history. I would strenuously argue with that. But it's because more than probably anything else in our story, the civil rights movement is an example. It's a case in which American citizens acted as citizens and secured their rights. They used all the rights in the First Amendment, the right of assembly, the right of petition, the right of free speech, the freedom of religion, the right of the press, and they use them to secure justice. And so, you know, we have still not become a perfect nation. The children in our schools today are facing a raft of problems that they are going to have to solve, and they're going to have to solve them not simply as elected officials, because most of them won't be elected officials. They need to solve them as active citizens, and they need to know what active citizenship looks like.
Your work is all about teaching tolerance. Does this help children learn tolerance, and how?
Plessy versus Ferguson was in 1896, and it was after Reconstruction. It was pretty much the South had tried to reinstitute a policy of racial control. And what it did was it ruled in relation to train seats that separate but equal was constitutional. And that led to a 70-year period of what are known as Jim Crow laws. And Jim Crow laws are the things that were responsible for those colored water fountains, the separate bathrooms, the separate facilities in the South. Those Jim Crow laws also led to separate schools. And there were a series of Supreme Court cases, or rather of cases, that started challenging school segregation as the late 1940s. But they culminated in one case, Brown versus the Board of Education, that basically charged that separate was inherently unequal. Now, in fact, the case was built on the evidence that the separate schools were actually quite unequal. But the argument was also made that even if they were equal, they sent out a powerful message of inequality and of second-class citizenship, and so that even if they were, quote-unquote, equal, they were inherently unequal. And with the Brown decision, and by the way, the Supreme Court voted unanimously to overturn school segregation in the Brown decision, you began to see the unraveling of segregation in the South. It did not happen immediately. It took almost 20 years. And there's an argument that can be made that it still has not happened.
Yes, a strong argument. Yes. And that brings me to my next question about what did children need to know about this, not just academically, not just information, mm-hmm. but for their own lives and to create change in the injustice many children are living.
Well, I think they need to be able to understand that, first of all, you need to be able to recognize injustice, name it, and understand how it comes about before you can fight it. I would like to give you a more contemporary example.
Yeah.
We get calls from superintendents of schools, and they're very upset because there's been some kind of racial incident in the school. A noose has been tied around the locker of a black student. A swastika has been painted on a sidewalk. And they say, how can this be happening? Don't they know? The fact is, we see these instances of racism even today. We worked with a superintendent in Utah a few years ago, and after an incident during a pep rally in which a white student donned what looked like a KKK headdress, this superintendent literally went to every single 11th grade class. Not one of those students could identify Jim Crow laws. They had no idea about the Ku Klux Klan. They had no idea why this was such an offensive symbol. we risk an enormous amount if we bury our racial past, because the reality is today that there's still a great deal of racial injustice. If we look at school dropout rates, they're greater for children of color. If we look at school discipline rates, they're greater for children of color. If we look at achievement rates, if we look at employment prospects. And what we really want is students who can look at that and say not, oh, that's just the way it is, but, hey, wait a minute, how can I change this?
So you're telling us why, and now tell us how. You've done years now of research mm-hmm. about teaching tolerance in schools at all levels. Mm-hmm. So tell us what works, what doesn't.
Well, there are two things that work generally. One is that it's important to increase empathy. There's your goal. Give people, in the words of Atticus Finch, a chance to walk in someone else's shoes. That's increasingly difficult these days because of the increased segregation of schools. So what we try to do is expose children to other people in as many ways as possible. You can do it virtually. For instance, we've just introduced a new curriculum called Perspectives for a Diverse America, and it's based on years and years of research around what's called contact theory. And contact theory says it's hard to hate somebody if you actually know them. So ideally, of course, you'd have integrated schools where there's a lot of intergroup contact among students. The reality is we don't have a lot of fully integrated schools. We have lots of segregation along socioeconomic levels and along race and ethnicity, and that's because of residential patterns. Our Perspectives for Diverse America curriculum decided to try to reach students through readings. And the idea is that every child needs windows and mirrors in their education. They need to be able to read a book that they can find themselves in. There's the mirror. But they also need a window into how other people are living and what their lives are like. Because basically, empathy ultimately means I see in some way that you are, in fact, just like me, that you have feelings like me, that you are hurt like me, and that you experience joy like me, and that you've struggled like I do. We run a program called the Mix It Up at Lunch Day program. It's largely symbolic, but what it does is it focuses on the most segregated place in any school, which is the cafeteria, and it urges students for one day to break out of their cliques or to break out of whatever groups they're at, sit randomly with people that they normally would not sit with, and engage in some conversation. So what we want to do is make the different more familiar.
We're talking with Maureen Costello. She's the director of teaching tolerance at the Southern Poverty Law Center. So how effective is it to teach children tolerance when they go home to parents and communities that are, shall we say, less than tolerant?
I think we could all name teachers who have influenced us and shown us how to think differently than what we've been brought up with. And that's certainly what we are hoping for. One of the ways you do it, sometimes you have to do it explicitly. And you have to say to kids, hey, you know what? There are different rules in baseball than there are in football. And there are different rules for how you behave in school and how you may behave at home. So what you do is you don't say your parents are wrong. What you say is, we have certain rules here, and we're going to not use certain language. We're going to treat each other with respect. We're going to listen to each other. And those are the rules for this environment. And as you go into the world, you're going to find that there are different rules for a bar than there are for an office.
Well done. I'll bet it took a lot of trial and error to get to that insight.
It has, but we've been helped along the way by lots of good scholars who do lots of great research. We take the research of others and we make it usable for teachers. We're a grassroots teachers organization, really.
You talked about racism in schools and prejudice and all our forms of mm-hmm. bullying, I guess. And, you know, it continues to be a major problem in schools at all levels. So what are the most effective ways schools, teachers, administrators, children are dealing with it?
The most effective way is to acknowledge it. The second way is that teachers and schools have to know how to recognize it. They need to monitor it, and they need to engage students and parents to be part of the solution. Excellent communication, some kind of way that students can report incidents. But more than that, and perhaps the most important thing, is that teachers and students have to learn how to be upstanders. An upstander is somebody who's not a bystander. They're not just standing by and watching it happen and maybe afraid that if I say anything, it's going to be directed at me. They really have to have techniques where they can interrupt it, stand by the target, and in some ways marginalize the person who's bullying.
What kind of techniques are there to teach a child who's all their instincts have them being a bystander.
There's actually a lot of really good techniques. Role-playing, practicing what you will say. And a lot of times when you're practicing what you will say, it's a signal to everybody else that they should kind of chime in as well. And that really happens. You can really work with kids that they will support the weakest one, support the target.
You're talking about instituting a cultural change.
Absolutely.
At that level.
Yeah. You cannot attack bullying without right. making a cultural change. Right. It's all about school climate. Schools have to be places where anybody walking into the door has this feeling that I'm welcomed here, I'm respected here, I belong here. And any child who's being bullied doesn't have that feeling and is not going to learn.
Hmm.
And bottom line is, and this is what critics will always say, what schools are for is to have children learn and to teach. I agree with that. But you have to create the conditions under which students can learn.
Hmm. It's so true. Maureen, there's so much positive going on in our world today with regard to civil rights and human rights. We've got a black president. We've got an Indian Miss America. There's a woman who ran for the nomination. We've got a woman who may well run again. We've got gay marriage looking, as through my eyes, to be the law of the land. And there's a lot of positive things going on. But with that, of course, there's also backlash. And we've seen this throughout our history as humans. So we're seeing a good deal of hatred towards gays in this country and around the world, and an increase in hatred in general. I read the Southern Poverty Law Center newsletter, and hatred's on the increase.
Sadly, yes.
And does that mean we just have to redouble our efforts to deal with it, or redouble our efforts to teach compassion?
I think we do. And, you know, the second part of that is it's not just teaching compassion, it's also correcting myths. And there are a lot of myths out there about gay people, about poor people, about people of color. So that's the educational challenge. One of the things that we've noticed at the center, and this is looking at the entire work of the center, is that, in fact, after Obama's election, for instance, hate seemed to tick up very, very rapidly.
Right.
And I think what we're seeing is that as change is happening, the reaction is really, really strong. And, you know, the other change that you did not mention is the big demographic change that we're undergoing. After a couple of decades of enormous integration, the browning of America is happening. And this is a nation that, you know, on one hand is the most religiously diverse nation on earth. In some ways will be the most ethnically and racially diverse nation on earth. And we need to be good at that. So we need to plug away. The long arc of history, I really believe in it, is that we're going to get there. But in the short term, I think what you're seeing and what you describe is a reaction from a group of people who are recognizing that they're now in a minority and they're really fearful. You know, you can call it white anxiety, you can call it, you know, a number of things, but they're really fearful that they're about to lose dominance and they're striking out.
Well, they're about to lose what they have, and we're all fearful of losing what we have.
Always.
So what I hear from you is that the way you're looking at our country is the way I look at individuals, that the path to comfort in life is to be who you are, only more so, and just continue to be who you are. And, you know, as the ethnic patterns change in our country, what you said is we have to be who we are. And if we can stop fighting against who we are, it might work out pretty well.
I think so. You know, identity is at the root of everything. We need to be comfortable with who we are, and we need to know who our neighbors and our fellow citizens are.
Maureen, you talked about the increase in hate crimes. Tell us how we know that.
We actually track hate groups more than hate crimes. However, the FBI does track hate crimes, and we work very closely with them. Sad reality is that most hate crimes are not reported. So we know that hate incidents of all sorts are happening around the country.
Hmm.
We're more concerned with the numbers of hate groups. And what we've seen in the last couple of years is a rise in so-called patriot groups, which are really scary because these are folks who are arming themselves and believe at some point that they're going to have to take down the government. And they're based on ideas about white supremacy and fears of what's happening. They think they're not being represented anymore.
Yeah, just what we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Maureen, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us and for coming up here from Alabama.
It's been a pleasure. I love coming to Philadelphia.
We can get much more information about Maureen and the Teaching Tolerance Program right on our website. Thanks again.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We're talking with Maureen Costello. She's the director of Teaching Tolerance at the Southern Poverty Law Center. And we'll be back after a short break when we'll be talking with Reverend Stephen Lawrence, pastor of the White Rock Baptist Church, and Divya Arya, high school student at Lower Merion, and she's president and founder of the Intercultural Youth Council. We'll hear from them in just 60 seconds. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, the Garrett and Tatiana Copeland Arrhythmia Center at ChristianaCare offers care for people who experience irregular heartbeat, also known as arrhythmia. For those with a racing heart or one that beats too slowly, who have had problems with their heartbeat or have fainted, an arrhythmia assessment may be needed. ChristianaCare encourages people with these symptoms to talk to a doctor. For more information or to make an appointment, 800-693-CARE or christianacare.org/arrhythmia.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
And we are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about what we're teaching our kids about civil rights and compassion and what we're not teaching them. We're joined now by Stephen Lawrence. He is the administrative assistant to the pastor of the White Rock Baptist Church. He's the chair of NUCOR. It's a group nurturing honest dialogue between different races and faiths here in Philadelphia. Reverend Lawrence, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And we're also joined by Divya Arya. She's a high school student at Lower Merion. She's going to tell us a lot more about the Intercultural Youth Council, whose mission it is to promote interfaith and intercultural dialogue. Divya, welcome.
Thank you, Dan. I'm glad to be here, too.
When we did that interview with Maureen Costello, you were really reacting to some of what you heard. So what are your feelings about what you heard in that interview?
When she spoke about the dropout rates of colored people and how there's a lot of problems in the differences between whites and blacks, I was surprised, frankly, because colored people in this day and age, I believe, should include more than just blacks. As she said, America is diverse, but African Americans are not the only ones suffering. And I think colored people also includes Asians. I'm of Indian descent. And that the conversation now is much more than just whites and blacks. And that when you talk about dropout rates of colored people, it's more than that.
So the word colored people harkens me back to my childhood in the 50s, and it made me feel uncomfortable. It's funny because the phrase people of color is fine. So what's wrong with us? Language?
Language, because it is so time-specific, really says something about people you're talking about and when you're talking about them. So for America, to talk about colored people really means you're talking about the 50s. That's when the NAACP gets formed, National mm-hmm. Association for the Advancement of Colored People.
Mm-hmm.
And then from colored to African-American to Afro-American to black to African-American. For that population in the United States, there's been a variety of names that we've used to describe ourselves. And people of color really is an attempt to talk about a larger group than just African-Americans. It's to try to make that circle wider. All of this is language that we use to try not to offend people when we talk to them.
We really struggle with language. You're recalling all the different words we use for black people, African Americans, and I almost make a joke about what people call me in a wheelchair, you know, from invalid to crippled to on, and now we're special needs. I don't know what we are. No, actually. But, you know, it's all an attempt to describe something, but we don't quite know what we're describing. It's a sense of otherness.
I think one of the things that we try to do at Nucor is to have the conversation and allow the conversation to build some kind of a base of understanding so that when you make, and everybody does this, when you make a language error, I'll call it, when you use a word that's out of date or out of time, or you make an assumption about a person thinking, well, this is what they like to be called because this is what I call all of them. But if you're in a group and you don't know anybody and you make that language error, then there's conflict because people that don't know each other get offended when they hear things they don't like. But if over time you've built some kind of a base of relationship and part of that base says, I want to get to know you, but I've grown up with these words in my head, and in my head they don't mean the same thing that they mean when they come out of my mouth. So when I make that error, because you're my friend, you're going to tell me, and you're going to work with me, and you're going to help me. Because without that help, I'll just keep making these errors all the time.
Yeah, I experienced that very much with my first job. It was the height of the women's movement, and you know, I just kept getting called sexist over and over and over again, and I didn't know what I was doing wrong, so I got defensive, I got angry, I became more sexist, and then finally, one of my students sat down with me, and she taught me. So I want to come back to you, Debbie, with language here. You were born in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Your parents were not.
Mm-hmm.
So you and your parents see the world through different lenses, I assume.
Of course.
Okay, so you go to one school, a private school in West Philly, and then you go to high school in the suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
What's the different experience?
I'd like to start off by saying that I agree with Reverend Lawrence about how when people make honest mistakes like that, when I said colored people, I didn't grow up in the 50s. I don't really know what the 50s are like. So I'm glad that he corrected me, and I think that willingness to listen and be informed about that is incredibly important to the whole conversation. And that was something that I experienced in the school that I attended in Philadelphia. And there I was called all sorts of names. I felt very, very self-conscious of my skin color, which is brown, unlike most of the white kids there. And I tried everything I could do to cover that up and act like all the other kids and feel sad and not proud of the fact that I am a Hindu and of my religion and my beliefs. But coming to a new school where just the environment is different, and when people, they still say these hurtful things, but they say it with that background of wanting to be informed,
for example,
it's different.
For example,
in my new school, I was actually asked if I was a terrorist in sixth grade. And I don't know, a nice, young, small, sixth grade girl who happens to have brown skin, of course, she's a terrorist, first thing you think. But when I think about those kind of experiences and the background that that kid was coming from, I know that he is not meaning to hurt me. He's not meaning to offend me, which is unlike the other schools where they were meaning to hurt me and meaning to demean me for being a different color. And when that experience comes, I was emboldened, and that's how this Intercultural Youth Council has started. You know, it inspired me to actually teach him what he was doing wrong.
I wonder if some of it, I mean, what you got in the school here in Philadelphia helped inform your life in a positive way.
Mm-hmm. It's the subconscious. It's the willingness to learn and the willingness to be informed, which is more about how you're raised than anything else.
It's more about how you're raised. And
it can be fostered. It can be fostered, that kind of willingness.
I want to turn to you, Reverend. Mm-hmm.
How?
How can it be fostered? I want to know what you're doing at Nucor.
At Nucor, we are having conversation. For the last 6 years, a group of clergy and lay people, variety of religious traditions, variety of ethnicities, we meet monthly, and it began with us having a conversation among ourselves. We tell personal stories, and then through those personal stories, instead of what normally happens in a conversation is you tell a personal story, and then when a person hears something in that story that they identify with, they'll cut you off and say, well, yeah, that happened to me too. So at Nucor, we practice listening. We let one person talk. When they're finished talking, instead of chiming in, we ask another question. We probe deeper. We go further. And over time, over the five-year period of this conversation and probing and listening, we've developed a community and a trust level that allows us to have conversations on race that are asking difficult questions and wondering about difficult issues. And I'm a believer that you can't start the first conversation with a difficult issue. There's the history of the country has not allowed us enough room to hear each other. As soon as I hear a key word, things flare up in me and I'm ready to attack. But if I know you and I hear that word, I respond to you much differently than if you're a stranger. And now there's an opportunity for us to build a bridge and work things through and learn from each other. And now I can ask that difficult question and get and have a conversation about it rather than have an argument or a debate.
Let me press you here, if I may. Come in closer to me. Tell me what that looks like, what that sounds like, that conversation. Give us an example.
Without betraying confidence.
Sure.
Let's see.
Talk about yourself.
Well, yeah, I guess that is the best way. the story that I like to tell about myself is part of true story and then part of made up story. My wife and I are at an event, and I'm having a conversation with someone who's not me, not black, not my age, whatever, and I may use a word that is offensive to that person, but it's something I grew up with, something I heard in my family, so I'm not aware that it's a difficult word. So I say that word and the person might wince, but my wife picks it up and I don't. So I go on and talk and talk and talk and talk and talk. And then when we're done and we're leaving or driving home, then she will say to me, next time when you're talking with my friend, say this instead of this. Or this word probably was not the best choice to use in that situation. So now I have a person who loves me, who's taking me to school about how to do this. And with that knowledge, I can now approach those conversations better in the future. I think that that's sort of the story of what happens when we talk with each other. We grow up with whatever the race concept is of ourselves and others and our family. We grow up with that in our heads. And when we get outside into the world and start talking, we're using that inside the house language. And it doesn't work outside the house.
But on the other hand, I mean, if we're so self-conscious about the language we use, it kind of takes us out of the conversation. Now, Divya, you want to respond to that?
Mm-hmm. And especially the youth level and what we do at the Intercultural Youth Council, when we have our discussions, I think it's very, very different than the adult discussions that go on, because kids tend almost to ignore the political correctness. And in fact, in the Intercultural Youth Council, it's almost funny sometimes. And it can hurt. That's true. We show people that it is not hard to stop them, quickly correct them, keep it going. And we ourselves make jokes about it, you know, and we make it a fun topic. Political correctness, that's terrible term, but if it's something that you've grown up with and then you learn that it's wrong and you want to change it, it can be done.
Tell us about the Intercultural Youth Council. What do you do? Who's in it?
So the Intercultural Youth Council, I founded it with Ayan Nelson of Bodine High School for International Affairs in Philadelphia. So we both come from very, very different socioeconomic backgrounds, ethnicities. We're different in almost every way, but we are the same in that we want to promote conversation between different backgrounds and help kids understand each other. Because as kids, you're inherently open-minded, I believe that, and that we must take advantage of that while you're still young, before your beliefs become these concrete, grounded things that are very difficult to change once you're older. As youth, at the grassroots level, the truly grassroots level, it's the time to have this conversation, and that's what we do. It consists of high school students from around the Philadelphia area, all different backgrounds, ethnicity, socioeconomic, and we have events where we ourselves facilitate discussions among people, among students and adults from both suburban and urban Philadelphia. And they come together and they discuss what they grew up with. And it's a very interesting mix of not only ethnicities, but also age. And that's what we do.
Where do you meet?
We meet at New Covenant Campus in Germantown, which in itself is very interesting because that is a church and many of our members are not Christian. And so in coming together in this space, the intercultural aura is already there.
Help me understand where this passion, this devotion for justice, where does that come from? I listened to what you've been exposed to, and some kids would get depressed and withdraw. Some would lash out in anger. And my God, there's plenty of evidence of both. And you're doing something like this. Do you even have an answer for that?
I must say that I used to take offense to it. And I think that's what happened when I put those walls up when I was younger. I took offense to it and I was like, I'm never going to let this happen again. I'm going to put my walls up and I'm going to try to fit in with anyone else, and I'm not going to be who I am. And in essence, I think I'm coming to my new school and being welcomed for that, it exposed me to this new greatness, and I'm never going to go back to being that closed thing. And if someone tries to do that, I'm going to show them that what I do is beautiful just as what they do is beautiful, and we can both be beautiful and get along fine.
I spent the first 33 years of my life working really hard to be same like other mm-hmm. kids, and then I became a quadriplegic and knew I would never be like the other kids. And boy, was that a relief. You know, I mean, it wasn't easy, but, you know, mm-hmm. just to, I am different. Mm-hmm. And that's who I am now. And in a way, it's got to be a relief for you, too.
Mm-hmm. And coming to terms with that has been a great experience. And it's also rewarding to help others come to that same belief and conclusion that being different is awesome. And you know, some kids they'll ask me a question about what is reincarnation, why do you think your grandma could be like a bug, you know, she was reincarnated as a bug, and you know, that's offensive, my grandma's not a bug, what are you saying? So but then I take pride in educating them, and when they understand truly what I believe about reincarnation and my beliefs, they wish that they had something like that too. I've gotten tons of comments like that, like, wow, I wish I was ethnic, like that's so awesome. But what they don't realize is that they too are ethnic, and that everyone has their own experiences, and whether you grew up in the United States for several generations, you're special, like you're completely different too, and you need to inform others of what those are, what your beliefs are.
Reverend Lawrence, a friend of mine said to me once years and years ago, she said, you're a teacher now, like it or not, you're a teacher. You have a choice about what you're going to teach, but you're a teacher.
Yeah.
Let's take a short break, and when we come back, I want to talk about empathy and what it takes to really learn about one another. And I want to talk about not just schools or private organizations. I want to talk about families too, and maybe we can open some doors in some lives here. We're talking with Reverend Stephen Lawrence. He's the administrative assistant. Did I get that right this time? Administrative assistant to the pastor of White Rock Baptist Church in West Philly, and he's the chair of New Core. Divya Arya is a high school student at Lower Merion. She's president and founder of the Intercultural Youth Council. We'll be back after just 60 seconds. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
The Wan Institute supports WHYY. They're a graduate school offering acupuncture and herbal medicine in Glenside and in Hahnemann Hospital. They have both faculty and student clinics. Details at woninstitute.edu.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Foundation helps private foundations by partnering on administration and grant making. Private foundations also can establish a donor-advised fund to save time and reduce costs. What's more, the Philadelphia Foundation also offers solutions when a private foundation has run its course. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philafound.org.
Supporting WHYY, the 2014 Lincoln MKX, which comes with available adaptive HID headlamps and standard heated and cooled front seats. More details about the Lincoln MKX are available at lincoln.com.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about equality across the board, civil rights, human rights, what are young people are learning, what they're not learning, and we're going to talk now about how we can improve the situation, what's being done. We're with Reverend Stephen Lawrence and Divya Arya, and I want to talk about empathy, and I don't know if that's being taught in schools. Let me turn to you, Divya. Is it?
I don't think so. I think empathy is one of those more social aspects that are taught in the way you're raised. And at school, they try to promote it. You know, there's all those posters all over school where they say empathy is great and, you know, you must walk in each other's footsteps. But it's hard to walk in each other's footsteps when you're just being told by a poster. And people need to foster it. And it's not going to happen on its own. And that's what we're trying to do, the Intercultural Youth Council, is foster this kind of empathy. But it seems that in schools, it's only certain people or certain groups in schools that are going to make that kind of change. Schools as a whole, it's very difficult to make empathy your goal.
How can it be taught, Reverend?
I'll confess that at NewCorps, we are fortunate to have people who have an interest in learning about each other. So they're willing to sit down and have a conversation. And because they're there, they're listening and they're open. And we do create a safe place for conversation. I think that's very important. If you think that you're going to be attacked immediately because of the way you look or the first incorrect word that you use, you're not going to come back to that kind of a setting. But when you realize that people are going to hear you, going to give you a chance, then people are more willing to share that conversation.
So people come in open or willing to be open.
Yeah, we've gained a reputation over time as a safe place to have conversation. It's not going to be debate. It's not going to be you make a statement and someone responds to it. It's not. It's going to be people talking and listening to each other.
How did you learn about compassion, Divya?
First, I want to address what Reverend said about how this is a safe place where you can talk about that, and schools often claim that. You know, this is going to be a safe place where you can say anything you want. But it's not. Of course not. In the classroom, of course, you might feel safe raising your hand, but as soon as you step outside that door, it's over. You know, your reputation, everything is on the line based on what you say in class. And so it's really more than just creating a safe environment. It's making our whole society a safe environment. And that comes from every individual themselves. And we start at the grassroots level. You start with youth and you keep it going from there.
So they've got compassion. It's in our hardwiring. We couldn't survive without caring for other. And you're right, Divya, it's easier with youth. But my concern, and I mentioned this to Maureen Costello, is what happens when you go home and there's not a lot of compassion or empathy there. I have a feeling you are one of the lucky ones that it is at home.
Yeah, with my family especially, my parents and I come from very different backgrounds, and conversation in the family is difficult. My mom can attest to that talking to me is pretty hard, you know, when I come home from a long day of school, I just want to sit in my room on my computer, you know. Teenagers and adults are very, very different. But keeping that compassion alive is very, very difficult, especially when people feel so challenged by others of different ethnicities and backgrounds.
You see this look on my face? I got one eyebrow up. Did you notice that as I was talking?
I did notice that. What do you think about this?
Where did you come from? Do you have any idea that you're a teenager, for God's sakes? What? Oh, my God.
I like to read, maybe?
No, it's more than reading. It's more this kind of compassion and openness.
I try to do it. I don't know. I'm not a perfect model.
Yeah, you're not getting that from bumper stickers or posters. So, Reverend Lawrence, what are we supposed to do in families? What can we do?
We actually have a card that we distributed during the Thanksgiving holiday called A Recipe for Conversation. And we were thinking of a scenario where someone goes away to college and they come home for the first time, and even in the 3 or 4 months since September, some things have happened to them, and they've become a different person, and they may have some different opinions. And here we are at Thanksgiving, and conversations get started, and sometimes they get rather heated. So we included a little card to take home with you that just says simple things like, sit down to your grandfather and ask your grandfather to tell you a story about something that happened earlier in their life, and listen to the story. And ask questions about the story and probe the story. And when that's done, your grandfather has this wonderful feeling of the grandson that came and listened to him. And that's a building block for more conversation. That when we interrupt each other, when we're sure that what we have is more important or more correct than the person that we're talking to, then conversation doesn't happen. And when conversation doesn't happen, we infuse ourselves in the world where we are. We've got to get another viewpoint on the world, and it's not going to come by concentrating harder where we are. We've got to get some input. We've got to get some conversation going. And it's wonderful when people begin to learn that this will work. It's one of the amazing things that happens at Nucor, and I wish I could describe it as viscerally as I'm feeling it. We will go through an evening, we'll gather people in a space, and I think they are ready for one person to talk and everybody to listen. And instead of that happening, several people will tell stories, and then we will divide people into small groups, and they will tell each other stories. And by the end of the evening, people are just excited. I met someone today that doesn't look anything like me, and I found we have so much in common. I met somebody that grew up in the same part of country that I grew up, but they're nothing like me. They've discovered things that we never discover because we don't have conversation. It's so exciting. It's just wonderful.
What you're creating is safety. Divya, you just won an award at Princeton. Tell us about the award and why you won it.
Yes. And so from the Philadelphia area, I was the winner, and there were several other finalists. And actually, on Thursday, I leave for the Princeton Prize Symposium, which is all of the winners from all over the nation, about 20 winners from several cities. And we meet together, have activities, talk about what we've done, give a little speech. And so I'm really looking forward to that and comparing notes. A similar conversation to this, I'm assuming.
Tell me about your future. What year are you in high school?
I'm a junior right now, 11th grade.
Yeah, tell me about your future. And I don't mean just the standard boring adult questions about what are you going to do, what are you going to study, all that crap. I want to know about your dream.
So, of course, I have my regular spiel for all the adults, like, where are you going to college? No. So I won't give you that one. I'll give you what I actually want. I'm very excited to study more about religion and how it plays into what people believe. Because what I've realized through my readings and through studying history in school is that people will give up everything, not for money, not for their families, for religion. They will give up their home. They will give up their lives. They'll even give up people for what they believe, their religion, and how that factors into government, how that factors into economics and everything. I think it's so important, especially in America and the multicultural world that we live in today. And so, not sure how that's going to take form, and maybe Secretary of State, WRA Secretary of State, or World Health Organization, or something that I can use that knowledge to make a difference in the way people interact with their government and politics and religion.
Bless your heart. And you know what? All of a sudden, that's my dream, too. So tell me, Reverend Lawrence, what's yours?
What's my dream? Oh, my gosh.
What do you want to do when you grow up?
What do I want to do when I grow up? How much time do I have left?
I want to know about your dream. I don't want to know about your plan. I want to know about your dream.
My dream is that my short-term dream is that I'll see some conversations going on intergenerationally, not for the point of trying to change each other, but for the point of hearing each other. And my dream is that those conversations begin to build a community of people who care about each other beyond the way we look and beyond the way we talk and beyond everything, and who will stand with each other when some outside force, whether it's something of our own creation, like racism, when some outside force demands that we behave another way toward each other, we will resist that force and resist the people that think that that's the agenda. It cannot be that only one people who suffer have the burden of overturning that. It has to be that we all agree this is a crazy way to live as a world. Let's stop this. Let's turn it around.
And there's something in it for those who allegedly are not suffering. You know, there's something in it. I mean, we all look for security. That's what we want in our lives. But, you know, we find that people who live in gated communities, for example, spend more money on individual security systems than people on the outside. That the more we look for this external security, the less secure we feel. And the more open we are, the more secure we feel. Because security is really a feeling. It's a sensation that, okay, this is okay now. I don't have to be scared at the moment.
And I think something that I've also realized is that people don't see themselves as tyrants. Almost everyone will see themselves as the victim of something. Of something has happened to them and that they're suffering an injustice and something must be done. So when people realize that suffering within themselves, they pinpoint a target. And it's important that we forget about who that target is and that we recognize that we are all suffering. And there's a lot of suffering going around, big, small, everything feels like the same magnitude to each person, probably, even if in real life, technically, it's different for it, the magnitudes are clearly different. So
I have long been of the feeling that the golden rule is not prescriptive, it's descriptive, so that we actually do treat our neighbors the way we treat ourselves. And we're not treating ourselves very well. And that if we could change that around, we would treat our neighbors better. We have to react with kindness and compassion to ourselves. Well, I want to tell you, we are out of time, but I want to thank you both so very much for not just coming out here, but for the work you do, for what you're all about. And you're changing the world in your own way. And I really, as a citizen, as an inhabitant of this planet, I thank you from the bottom
thank
of my
you.
Heart.
Thank you. Thank you.
We've been talking about civil rights, human rights with Reverend Stephen Lawrence and Divya Arya Early. We heard from Maureen Costello at the Southern Poverty Law Center. Well, to download our podcast, go to whyy.org/voices. You can follow us at Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. You can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show have been Kevin Griffin and Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Gita Simons is our producer. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Have a great week, my friends.